Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today I'm joined by Leshek Gadewa. How is that?
Perfect. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you for joining us once again. Last time we spoke about women in the Viking Age, which was a fascinating episode. But today we're going to look at the Slavic and Nordic mythologies and the similarities, the differences. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here and happy to be sharing some stories from my part of the world. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we were discussing, you have possibly the biggest collection of books I've ever seen in my entire life.
I have a lot, yes.
We were just talking about, and you've collected these from all over the world.
For the last 20 years or so, and across Europe and the wider world. So, yeah.
And yeah, you said it's one of the reasons why you think you can write so much.
I guess so, because it's just within hand's reach. It has all my post-it notes and everything. So it just makes life much easier and makes writing so much faster.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, absolutely. So I think for most people listening to this, and myself, you know, we certainly for myself, I've learned a lot about Nordic mythology over the years, particularly from Matthias. And I've heard of Slavic, and I've heard of Slavic mythology, and I've heard briefly of the Vikings going to the east. But I think a lot of the fixation always tends to be on the west. So I guess quite embarrassingly, I probably don't know as much about what Slavic mythology even is. So if that's a good starting point.
Yeah, it's a great starting point. I think before we start talking about Slavic mythology, I think for some of our listeners, perhaps it would be valuable to just say a few words about the Slavic world as such and the Slavs. So if you check the term Slavs on, let's say, Wikipedia, you will see that the Slavs are actually the largest ethno-linguistic group in Europe. So it's a very vast world and a lot of people that speak these Slavic languages and that spoke Slavic languages back in the Viking Age that interests us most here. Mm-hmm. So essentially, to make a very, very long story short, the Slavs or the Slavic world can be divided into three zones or three areas. So you have the Western Slavic world, which back in the Viking Age comprised of parts of northern, northeastern, northwestern Germany, Poland, today's Czech Republic, and Slovakia. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Eastern Slavic world, which is essentially the countries to the east from Poland's eastern border today. So that's Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And then you have the Southern Slavic world, which is some of the Slavic countries in the Balkans. Okay. So these are three different sort of parts of what we consider as the Slavic world. And of course, as it is today, it was sort of roughly similar in the past. These different areas and these different people had slightly different customs, different languages, different beliefs in some regards, different material culture and different ways of expressing their identities. So it's in talking about Slavic beliefs or Slavic mythology, the basic question that arises is, was there one Slavic mythology or some religious system of belief, or were there actually a couple or several, or did it have local variants? And of course, we have to say immediately, and we have to answer, yes, of course. And it was exactly the same in Scandinavia. We have this kind of concept of, or modern construct of Norse mythology, but we know from texts and we know from archaeology that in different parts of the Viking world, or even in different parts of Scandinavia, people did things differently. And that there was a lot of regional variety, social variety, variety in terms of material culture and expressions of belief. So it's mm-hmm. we can say the same for the Slavic world.
Yeah.
What I do,
just to jump in, just to even pull it back to you in its more kind of raw form, I guess. What qualifies something to be Slavic? Is it just the geographical location,
yes.
or is it the language? Like,
yeah, I would say it's the geography. It's definitely the language. It's a certain cultural model, a combination of geography, language, ancestry, if you like. Yeah, mm-hmm. some sort of tradition. Yeah, but on a very basic level, the life ways of the Slavs in the Viking Age were pretty much the same or very similar to the life ways and everyday realities of people from Northern Europe, okay. especially from Southern Sweden or Denmark. The landscape is not that much different. And, they were farmers. They were animal herders. They engaged in all kinds of similar activities, fishing, carpentry, production of metal objects, in a sort of civilizational sense, mm-hmm. they were on the same level.
I assume they wouldn't be as seafaring, or is that just very?
They were actually, perhaps not as much as the Scandinavians, but we actually don't know for sure because. The Scandinavian world, when it comes to ship building traditions and all the stories about these long voyages and raids, we have a lot of sources that inform us about where these people went, what they did. Mm-hmm. For the Slavic world, we have this big problem that we don't have the sources, especially texts. And I'll come back to this later on, but it the impression that it was mainly the Scandinavians who ruled the seas of the Viking Age may be slightly misleading, so to say. Okay. And it may be just an impression based on the sources that we have for Scandinavia.
Do you think that it is pretty much purely down to the quality of sources that we have?
It is.
Because it is that idea of when you think of, first and foremost, it's called the Viking Age, I guess. And you do just think of these seafaring people who went to North America, down to Istanbul, around Spain, they're conquering the seas. And you really don't even hear about the Slavic culture. And it's probably, it's quite sad to say. And for you, it must be very frustrating for being your history as well, that you don't get that kind of mention the same.
Yeah, well, there are many reasons why the Slavic world is not sort of doesn't feature so prominently in discussions on the Vikings and the Viking Age. And if you open books called The Viking World, usually you'll have a little bit about Vikings in Rus, so in this Eastern Slavic world, but hardly anything about the Western Slavic world. So, for instance, the area of Poland today, parts of Germany, Czech Republic, Slovakia. There's very little about it, and this part of the Slavic world actually had a lot of connections with Scandinavia, especially with Denmark. So that's very interesting. Of course, another reason for this is the linguistic barrier, because until relatively recently, most of the research concerning the Slavic world was published in Slavic languages, or in German. And occasionally in English. So those who did not read Slavic languages from Northern or Western Europe or German, they just would not be able to access the sources, these articles, the archaeological material. So that created a problem, certainly. And, there's also a political, historical side to this, because as until 1989, Poland was isolated from the Western mm-hmm. and Northern world, so it was under Russian occupation essentially. So that of course also created certain barriers, and And some scholars, I think they still have an iron curtain over their over their brains. But
hopefully it's not coming back anytime soon.
A lot of things have changed since 1989. Yeah.
It's not that's not that long ago though. You know, I was born in 1989, so that's what, 34 years ago. It's not long when you really, when you put into scale things. So hopefully that changes and kind of things start to free up a little bit more. So would the language barrier have been as much in the Viking Age as well? Because I think I can't remember who I spoke to. I think it might have even been Matthias who said that he thought that the peoples of the Anglo-Saxons would probably be able to understand the Nordic languages, or enough to kind of just get by and just get on. Whereas, how different is it when it comes to?
It's very different, actually. It's very different. So, even today, I am a native Polish speaker, so I can communicate on a basic level with practically any Slav, whether it is Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Czech Republic, Slovakia.
Oh, okay.
I can talk to these people. We may not be able to, get into very profound topics, but on a very basic level, we can communicate.
Yeah.
These languages are different, but they are very different from English or from German or from any Scandinavian language. So I presume that back in the Viking Age, people from the Slavic world and from the Scandinavian world could probably communicate on some very basic fundamental level, but anything more complicated would have required a translator or the use of some other language. And of course, among the elite of the time, and we're talking about the very late Viking Age or even the post Viking Age period, the elite would have presumably the elite, they would have spoken Latin or Greek, maybe. So they may have been able to communicate in those languages. But if these societies lived pretty much alongside and, mixed and mingled and intermarried, then I can fathom the possibility that there, through these intercultural marriages, some people were bilingual and they could speak some Slavic and some Old Norse or both languages very fluently. So we will never know, but the bottom line is these languages are and were different.
I didn't know that they were similar enough. I guess it is very ignorant of me that I just don't know that much about that area of the world. And I know if I see Russian written down, I'm just like, there's no way I can even try to figure this out. But I didn't realize that it was so similar with all the other Slavic countries that you could.
Similar
that you could kind of get by and understand some basic conversations, I guess. It is quite embarrassing that how little we get taught about this area of the world, particularly for me at school as well. I don't think we even touched on that whole Eastern European area. It's just not something that comes up, and it is quite disappointing when you start to talk about it in like this. Me and you go back, and I really think about how much I know about that area of the world. Embarrassingly little.
Well, that's why we're meeting. That's why we're having this conversation, so we can, exchange ideas and exchange thoughts and learn from one another. And I think that's the point. That's how we learn. We cannot know everything, and we just have to be open and willing to listen and to learn.
Absolutely.
That's why we're here. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. For sure. So do you think where would be a good starting point? Do you think when it comes to?
Well, I have a little PowerPoint which I can show, because it's always good to talk and have some pictures when we're talking about archaeology and we're talking about geography. So what I'll try to do, and you guys can tell me if you can see things. I'll try and share this PowerPoint with you guys.
Yeah, just as Leszek is putting that up. For anybody who's just listening to this, you'll be able to watch this on our YouTube channel, and also you can get early access to it via our Patreon, which is just Nordic Mythology Podcast. No, Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. It's £3 a month, and then you can get early access to all the episodes and all the videos on there. Go sooner, so you're gonna be able to see all the little bits that Leszek is gonna pull up.
Yeah, and I'll try to explain what we're actually looking at as well. So it's those that are listening will be able to imagine at least a little bit of what we're talking about. So yeah, so I've just made this little PowerPoint that gives you a bit of an introduction into this Slavic world. So here you can see a map of Europe showing roughly the location of the Western Slavic world. So that's the part of the Slavic world that I'm mostly interested in, and the part that we will be talking about today mostly. Mm-hmm. So as I said, this Western Slavic world is the areas of today's Poland, Czech Republic, Northern and Northeastern Germany, and Slovakia. That is the Western Slavic.
Even the Western
Slavic world.
Even just looking at that map, because again, it's because I assume that it's not the part of the map I usually look at. You know, I'm always looking over this left-hand side where I am. When even just looking at that, you know, 2 seconds of you putting that up, I've just gone, oh, I can't believe how close Sweden is to...
Exactly. That's what I was just about to say. Look how close it is to Scandinavia. It's just right across the sea. And I have to remember...
It was like over to the side, and they're going east to get there. Yeah. But it's really not. It's just... South.
Basically next door neighbors, the Slavs mm-hmm. and Scandinavians. And, and you have to remember that in the Viking Age, the Baltic Sea was like a Viking Age motorway. It was almost like a big lake, basically. So there was a lot of traffic. There was a lot of activity going on. Of course, there are also islands where people mingled and integrated on even greater scale, in places like Bornholm or Gotland, for instance. All these islands, they witnessed a lot of activity and cultural exchange. There are a lot of Slavic traits on both Gotland and Bornholm, and other islands on the Baltic. So these worlds were very, very mm-hmm. close, and that's why I'm showing you the map.
It's so much closer than England is on Scotland.
Yeah. It's
so much closer. So it makes complete sense that there would be contact and exchange.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, what I guess we're going to look at and talk about today is the later part of the Viking Age. So the 10th and 11th centuries. And in the part of the world, of the Slavic world that I come from in Poland, this was a very interesting time, which was a time of armed struggles and a major ideological change. And I bring up this slide, and it shows very romantic images of two rulers of Poland in the 10th and 11th centuries. The gentleman to the left was called Mieszko, and the gentleman to the right was called Bolesław, or Burisleifr, as he is sometimes known in Old Norse texts. And these mm-hmm. are the two first historical rulers of what was to become in later decades or centuries Poland. Of course, we have this whole mythology of pagan kings and these legendary kings, but we're not entirely sure if they actually existed or if they had the names that some sources attribute to them. But these two guys, they were real. They really walked the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were the bringers of change, as I mentioned, because the 10th and 11th centuries was a time when they were conquering and uniting the various scattered tribes in this territory, and subjecting them to their own rule. But it was also the time when they, both Mieszko and Bolesław, realized that in order to maintain power, they need to convert. They need to accept this new religion that is gaining a very strong foothold in in Europe. So they had, they knew that they have to convert. And I often say in lectures and in public talks that in this time and in the late Viking Age, being Christian or converting your realm to Christianity was like a passport to the European Union. That was that. If you want to be part of a club of important players, important gentlemen, people who are active on a very wide European arena, you have to be Christian. Otherwise, you will be sooner or later wiped out. Whether or not these guys really converted out of pure, you know, spiritual need, and whether or not they actually believed this and accepted the Christian God is unclear. And I, to be honest, I sincerely doubt it.
Yeah.
But of course, and we will see that in the following slides, why I doubt it. But of course, that was a necessary political move.
So I have to ask you, because I feel the same. I have the same opinions when it comes to, like, the Christianization of Europe in the Viking Age. But there's such a narrative in modern day of how Christianity was this big evil thing that swept across Europe and, I guess, forcefully converted everybody and everything that it touched. And that is just very much the narrative of the time at the minute. It's very anti-Christian. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered your opinion on that, because I'm very much similar. It's just like, no, there was a lot of people who chose to because there was a lot of benefits to it.
On the one hand, yes. But I think that at least in the case of the Slavic world, this was a very violent process, a very brutal, bloody process. And people were generally, I feel unwilling, for the most part, unwilling to convert. And there are some sources signaling several so-called pagan uprisings, where people would sort of revert back to their old beliefs. They would not want to follow in the footsteps of the Christian religion. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of opposition here, and it wasn't a peaceful process. There was a lot of tension.
So would it be a case of the higher ups, the elites, convert relatively peacefully because there's a lot of benefit for them?
Exactly.
But the lower down, the everyday person is very against it, exactly, because it's not, they don't have to benefit from it.
I think that's exactly the case, that the elite did it rather peacefully and out of necessity. But when it comes to the conversion of their subjects, that doesn't go easy, and that that is a violent process.
Okay, so you can't just put it into one kind of neat little box and say
the official date for the Christianization of Poland, the one that you find in history books, but one that is also very much debated by professional historians and archaeologists, is 966. But I'd say it takes another 200-300 years for Poland to be more or less Christian. So it takes several generations to
I always wonder how they get like the single date for things like that. This is completely off topic. I've been wondering this for a while. There always seems to be some sort of correlation between the 66 ending and events happening. Like, what? You must have noticed.
If you turn
that. What
the
is
nine
that?
From 966, you'll have 666, right?
I guess nobody, like, you have like 1066.
Yeah.
And is 1666 one? Was that the Great Fire of London? One of them. There's like
there's something like about the six and the nine, right?
Yeah, there always seems to be like this 66 ending to like events, and there isn't a reason for it, surely, but it's always fascinating me still, like, why stuff seems to happen then.
Yeah. Well, one other thing that I bring up on this slide, and you can see it in the lower lower left corner is this fabulous stone statue. And I think that's actually a good starting point to talk about, yeah, Slavic mythology and Slavic belief. And and some of you may be familiar with this find. It's known under several different names. We call it in Polish Światowid ze Zbrucza. So in English, it would be something like Svantevit from Zbrucz. And Zbrucz is a river in modern day Ukraine. And this is actually where this statue was found in 1848. A local person was walking along the river and suddenly noticed a human head emerging from the waters and was terrified and thought it was someone drowning in the river. So he was trying to help, and then realized that it's actually not a human and that it's a stone statue that has somehow come up from the water depths. So what they did is they brought a pair of oxen, and then they tied ropes to this strange statue, and they pulled it on shore, and then they realized that it's actually a pretty massive, almost 2 meter long pillar with four sides and four faces and a very elaborate iconographic program, if you like, a lot of images here.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this.
Yeah, it's
very different to the kind of particularly I've been spending a lot of time going around like and seeing like Anglo-Scandinavian stone sculptures. Like you get a lot of crosses and that kind of thing, and this is nothing like those. It's completely different. The figure at the top is quite terrifying.
Well, let's maybe talk a little bit about what we actually see here. So you clearly have a three-tiered division here on this pillar or this statue. So you have the upper level, where on each of the four sides you can see a standing figure, and you can also notice that the hands are arranged in a very particular way. So you usually have the right hand somewhere close to the heart, and then the left hand somewhere in the sort of groin belly area.
Mm-hmm.
Some modern neo-pagans, they think it's actually a gesture of prayer, that this is how they would have prayed. You know, you're kind of touching your heart and you're bowing. And that if you look at recreations and reenactments of past rituals, that's how people often address their gods or bow to them. Okay. We don't know if this was the case back in the day, but it's an interesting idea.
It seems as if it's quite clearly done on purpose.
Yeah,
you know, they're each one of the four sides, whilst they're maybe holding different things, their hands are very clearly in the exact same position.
Yeah, you can see that there are different attributes. So on one side you have this object that looks like a ring or a cup, and we actually don't know if it's either a ring or a cup. There are different ideas of what this thing, this ring-like feature represents. Mm-hmm. Then on another one, you clearly see a horn, most likely a drinking horn.
Yeah.
And the remaining two, they don't have any attributes, but one of the sides has a saber and a horse.
Yes.
And that is really interesting. Why is there a saber? And that is an Eastern European, or you could even say a nomadic type of weapon. It's not really the kind of weapon that an average Western Slav, for instance, would have used, or certainly not something that a Scandinavian Viking would have used on a regular basis. So based on this detail, some people have actually even speculated that this statue has nothing to do with the Slavs, that it's actually maybe something designed or linked to the beliefs of other people from Eurasia and these, you know, Eastern steppe areas and so on.
Okay.
But
is that frustrating that people would just attribute it elsewhere because of one element? Could it not just be that maybe at some point somebody traded a saber and they're like, this is a really, because I imagine even more so if it's not native necessarily to that region, if one does come there through trade, like a trade network, it's kind of maybe a revered thing. It's a special item that then would end up on a stone, because it's like, well, we don't see this every day, and this clearly influential person has this cool weapon.
Yeah, there can be so many interpretations. And again, you know, it's the question of who was the designer and who was the sort of executioner of the idea in stone, and who was the commissioner of the statue, and maybe, you know, the person who commissioned this statue wanted the carver to make a Slavic idol, but the person who actually made it came from the nomadic area, and, you know, they thought, okay, they need a weapon, so we'll put a local saber here. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We will never know. But I'm a sort of firm believer in the idea that this statue represents Slavic ideas. Mm-hmm. So if we go further, then you can see.
Just before we do, would we assume that all four sides are the same person, just in holding different things?
That's a good question. And then again, there are different interpretations here. So according to some, there are four different deities represented on the top level. And then different names are attributed to them. And one of the names that can be attributed to one of the faces is Perun. And that is the Slavic god of thunder, a kind of equivalent to Thor in Old Norse mythology, the thunder god, the god of the sky. And that is the warrior god. So with him, we can link the face with the saber and the horse.
Okay.
But we don't know. The one reason why this whole pillar or statue is called Svantevit is because we have the account of a certain Saxo Grammaticus, a very well-known medieval writer, historian, so to say. And Saxo gives a very detailed account of a Slavic temple, not in the Eastern Slavic world in Ukraine, but actually in what is today Germany, Northern Germany, on an island, called Rügen in the north of Germany. And Saxo describes a Slavic temple, and the temple is dedicated to a god called Svantevit. Now, we don't actually know if the name Svantevit refers to is actually the name of the god, or if it's a description of who the god is and what this god does. And if we were to deconstruct linguistically the name Svantevit, it would be something like Holy Lord or Holy Man, something like that. So maybe it's just a nickname for a god. Okay. But Saxo writes that in this temple, there was a statue that had four necks and four heads, and the heads were looking in different directions, and that people would worship this god in this famous temple and bring all kinds of offerings. Okay. The temple also had special priests responsible for all the ritual acts. There was also a special horse in the temple, a white horse that they used to foretell the future. And the ritual that involved the horse, a divination ritual, was a ritual where they would lead the horse through three rows of spears thrust in the ground and forming a kind of cross symbol. Mm-hmm. And if the horse walked through this row of spears with its right leg or right foot, that's a good omen. But if the horse does it with the left foot, that's a bad omen. So the Slavs would conduct this ritual to find out, for instance, if they should embark on an expedition or on some kind of military campaign. So they use the horse to foretell if the campaign is going to be successful or not. And they
I've never heard of a ritual.
Yeah. The priest guided the horse, and the horse was saddled and bridled. And in the belief of the Slavs, they thought that the horse, well, kind of technically it's without a rider, but actually it's the god, the deity that rides the horse.
Okay.
And in this way communicates with the people and gives them certain information.
And it's all about which leg.
Yeah. It's all about which leg goes first. Exactly. Yeah.
At what point is it stood still? and it's which is the first leg as it sets off walking?
Yeah.
Or is
yeah.
it as
okay. it walks. It walks across the thrust spears. So kind of yeah.
I feel like that's not a very accurate way to there's
certainly room for manipulation, and I'm sure the priests knew how to.
Oh yeah, I'd be like
guide their horse in the way they desired.
Yeah, they're just like okay, now.
But it's interesting because this account by Saxo Grammaticus referring to Arcona, and on this left side the slide you can actually see a modern photo of this Cape Arcona where this stronghold with the temple was located. It's actually a beautiful place. If you want to go for a nice holiday in northern Germany, I would highly recommend going to Rügen and Arcona to see this place.
Wow.
But it's interesting because Saxo describes this Svantevit. And the statue and the four-faced statue as being made of wood, whereas what we have on the right-hand side is a stone pillar. So it's kind of similar, but also a little bit different. But okay. Maybe also because the distance between Rügen and Zbruch, where the statue was found, is several thousand kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So here again, we have this possible expression of diversity and differences in different parts of the Slavic world. But I want to get back to the statue because there's a lot of other things going on here.
I was going to also just ask, I have so many questions coming up.
So
the one with the horse and the saber, he has no feet. Do you think there's any significance to that? Or I'm just trying to work my way down to make sure I don't miss anything as I'm going.
That's an interesting idea. And I must say, I actually have never thought about this. So I think I won't try and answer this right now.
Okay.
But it's an interesting thought that it's because he's on the horse, so you can't see the feet so well. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know why I just that stood out to me when I was looking at it. I was like, why does he have no feet?
I need to think about that.
Oh well, I've done my job.
Thank you for that.
in your next book, you can just
I will reference you.
Just,
yeah.
just a little reference to me. That will make me so happy.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the middle tier because that's actually interesting. So here you have again four figures, and they have their arms stretched and sort of splayed fingers, and this level of the statue has been interpreted as the middle world, whereas the part above is the upper world, so it's the divine world.
Okay.
And then the middle world is what you see in the middle, and you have these figures, and you can clearly see the breasts, so you can kind of guess that these are women and men. And the stretched arms, this has been interpreted as a gesture where they are actually holding hands and dancing, forming a kind of circle and dancing around the statue.
Yeah,
there's also one interesting detail.
Obviously, we're looking at it flat. So when you put it in a three-dimensional square, they actually would be holding hands.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see that the thumbs are also pointing down. So it's like holding hands.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
There's also a very interesting detail on the second, you can call it the second side of the statue, where you see a sort of a larger female-looking figure, and then a tiny figure next to her.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
And this, we don't know why. Was it a mistake, or is it there for a reason? I'd like to believe everything is for a reason. And this has sometimes been interpreted as the human soul, as a kind of miniaturized representation of the human soul.
Oh wow!
But we don't know. We don't know. When we don't have textual sources to back this. To back this up, but it's a very interesting thought. But this essentially, I think, where we can agree is that this is the middle world.
Yeah,
the kind of Midgard of the Slavic imagination.
Yeah, and I definitely would agree with you that I would say everything, like you say, everything is for a reason. I wouldn't think that it's a mistake. You're creating something like this, and you're putting so much time and effort into it. You're not going to accidentally leave a little figure in there. It's there for a reason.
Yeah. And then comes the lowest world, the lowest part of the statue, which is different because here you can see three heads or three figures or a figure with three heads. that seems to be kind of holding and supporting the tiers above.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting case because we actually know of a Slavic deity, a Slavic god, whose name is Triglav. So the name translates to the three-headed one. And based on surviving sources, texts, folklore, etc., we can speculate that this was the god of the underworld, that it was the three-headed god of the underworld. So essentially what this statue seems to represent is a vision of the Slavic world and of the Slavic cosmos and of some of the deities responsible for governing it or controlling its different spheres. And we can also see that they had this kind of Indo-European concept of a three tiered, layered universe. So you have the upper world, the middle world, and the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very basic sense, this is something that you can also say about Norse beliefs. Of course, they had many other worlds that were possibly differently distributed, both in a horizontal and in a vertical sense. But the idea of the world being arranged on some sort of axis, and we called it the axis mundi, the world axis, is something that shines through this strange pillar from Zbruch.
Is that idea something you see across most religions? Because I guess Christianity is very similar, that it has
heaven,
hell, and earth. And then we have here. And obviously you have little places in between like purgatory. But for the most part it's the three places.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So this, for many years, this statue combined with some of the sources that we have has been sort of the number one find when talking about Slavic religion. And if you look at publications entitled Slavic mythology, this is what usually ends up on the cover. This find. And if you would like to see it in real life, you can see it in Krakow. In the archaeological museum in Krakow.
Okay.
There's a special room dedicated to the statue, and it's quite a sight. I think it's quite spectacular.
Like you say, it's something that I've never seen before, and this could be very. I don't know if when I looked at it originally, I couldn't help but think of like Aztec. And that could be complete. I don't know. Like I could be completely wrong with that. But that maybe to my untrained eye, that was the first thing that I went to, rather than having any link to kind of Scandinavia. It just went straight to that part of the world. I was like, oh, it looks more South American.
But there's one interesting aspect that's maybe worth mentioning here, because we've kind of established that it represents a universe that consists of three parts. But in thinking about the statue as such, there's one interesting detail. It would not stand on its own like this. It would just tip to the side, and it has no base.
Okay.
So this raises the question of how was it actually assembled in some holy grove or on a mountain, or how did they stabilize it in the ground? And I have this idea that perhaps the lowest part, which represents this, you know, three-headed god of the underworld, was actually below surface, underground.
Okay. So
in this way, the first level and the only level that people would be able to actually see in the course of rituals and so on would be the human level, the one on which they are themselves, right? The level where you have these dancing figures, but they know the deep down there below the soil level underground that there is this three-headed deity waiting for them one day. That's the only way to stabilize, to make the statue actually stand.
But would you, I guess, would you not see like a different kind of way of it weathering? If the bottom was underneath, would there be? I assume that would weather slower than the middle and the top.
There are actually traces of erosion on the statue, and also because it was actually in a river, presumably for about 1,000 years. We don't know how it ended up in that river, presumably as a result of Christianization. They just, you know, pulled the statue down and could not really destroy stone, so they just drowned the god, because that's what you do.
I guess that's better than just smashing it up.
They did in Arcona, as we know from the descriptions of Saxo Grammaticus, the Christians, they chopped the statue into pieces and burnt it. Wow. That's how they dealt with it, because you have to kill the god and its representation, its effigy, in a spectacular way. So there they could chop it up, but here they couldn't really chop it up, so they just drowned it in the river. But,
so disappointing to think of how much stuff we must have lost.
Oh yeah, yeah. But what's interesting in talking about these traces of erosion is that there are hints suggesting that the statue was actually painted, and that there are some traces of pigment and some traces of paint. So it most likely had red or dark brown coloring in different parts. We can't quite, you know, understand how these different colors were arranged, but it wasn't as plain as it is now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course, the same goes for a lot of ancient statues. You know, you go to these galleries of ancient statues and all these, you know, Greek and other monuments. They look plain, but they would have been originally painted, and sometimes in very vivid colors. And this most likely was the case also with this Spantevit statue.
That's such a good point, because we get so used to seeing these as just stone colored. And I was recently at Durham Cathedral, which is maybe one of the most beautiful cathedrals I've ever been to. And when I was talking to one of the gentlemen there, he was saying how traditionally before the Protestants, it was all painted. It was all like very bright and vivid. And then they have like a little section where it's been repainted. It's maybe kind of what it would have been like. And it's remarkable. And it makes such a difference to what you see in all the patterns and the details. And then even on top of that, you don't know what details are then painted on that we just don't have anymore. And it's when you start to think of things like that and how, you know, it would have been so different rather than just this stone slab, I guess.
Yeah. So that's kind of Slavic mythology, the iconography and archaeology of Slavic mythology, lesson one. But what you can already kind of gather from this is that there's not so much in the archaeology that we can lean on, and there is actually not so much in the textual world that we can use in our reconstructions of their worldview. And that is the major difference between the Slavic system of belief and the Scandinavian system of belief, because of course, you know, the poetic Edda and the sagas are very rich in detail, and of course they are written from a Christian perspective, most of the in most cases, at least the sagas, but still they preserve a lot of authentic details, it seems. Whereas in the case of the Slavic world, we only have Christian, or in some cases Arabic, sources, and we have practically nothing from the Viking Age or from the medieval period written in the vernacular and by the Slavs themselves.
So is this one of the only?
There are other sources than Saxo Grammaticus, but again, he's not Slavic, and
I was meaning the actual stone. Statues.
Well, no, there's more archaeology.
Oh, okay, sorry.
There's very little texts.
Okay.
That survive, and that is the problem in trying to figure out what was the mythology. You know, what were the myths? Did they have any myths at all? What were the names of the gods and all these supernatural creatures?
Yeah, I guess you need the two together. You need the archaeology.
You need the two together, and that has always been a big problem in research on Slavic beliefs. Mm. And one way to tackle this problem is to use folklore, and people have been quite eager more eager in the Slavic world than in Scandinavia to use folkloristic materials in trying to reconstruct these pagan beliefs from the Viking Age.
Okay.
And of course, the problem with folklore is that it's, you know, from the 19th and early 20th centuries. So it's kind of chronologically removed from the Viking Age by about, yeah, almost 1,000 years. So this, of course, raises the question, well, how reliable is it? Can we at all use it?
Mm-hmm.
I think in some cases we can. And so we can try and talk about one of the basic myths, if you like.
Before we jump on, can I just ask you, is there any significance to the clothing that the god figure is wearing? Because obviously he very much seems to be wearing a hat. And then on the bottom half, it's not trousers. It's either way, like it's a dress. I mean, with that, I don't want to come across as being rude. It almost looks like he's got a towel wrapped around his waist. That's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I think it's some sort of tunic-like garment, which is basically what people back in the Viking Age across Europe would have worn, especially men.
Okay.
You have this, you know, long tunic that's kind of goes all the way to your knees or slightly lower than the knees. And I think in this case, this band in the middle of the figure is most likely some kind of a belt.
Okay.
Either a leather belt or maybe some kind of organic strap made of woven linen or wool or silk. We don't know, but
okay. It looks quite
legit, I think.
Yeah, and okay.
Quite appropriate. When it comes to the hat, that's a slightly unusual feature, and again something that has these Eastern Oriental analogies, so to say, because this is a hat we sometimes call kopak, and it's an Eastern type of hat. Again, a hat that would have been worn by people of the Rus areas, the Rus territories. It's not the kind of hat that would have been worn among the Western Slavs, for instance. So okay. Again, it's an Eastern type of hat. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I just wondered if there was any significance to that, because I guess for me, looking at this for the first time, it looks like he would be topless, and then from the waist down, then have clothing. But as you've said it, and I kind of then look up, then it's a belt, and he's wearing a tunic. But from just like the very highest virgin eyes on this, it was like, oh.
But that's great,
like,
because
something about the bottom.
Yeah, I love this approach, and it's great when people who are from a sort of different world and who have never seen this before look at it for the first time, because guys like me, we've seen it a billion times and we're so used to it that certain things we just don't notice them anymore, or we never notice them. So it's great to have somebody else's opinion on it. I think that's really can be very fascinating.
Like you're missing those legs.
Yeah, that's an interesting detail. But if we may, let's try and talk a little bit about the actual myths,
yes,
or
please.
About the actual myth. What I'm going to tell you in a sort of fairy tale fashion is what seems to be one of the basic myths that structures the Slavic worldview and their understanding of the world. And I have to say that this myth is not something that is found in the Slavic poetic Edda or some heroic tales. We don't have anything like that from the Viking Age, or especially when it comes to the Western Slavic part of the world. But we have folklore, as I said, and the story I'm about to tell you comes from folkloristic accounts, and what I'm going to tell you is a kind of an amalgam of several variants of the story. There's actually 50 different, or more than 50 different variants of this story. So the story begins a long time ago in a galaxy not so far away, somewhere in the Slavic world. And there is only an endless ocean. There's nothing else. There are no animals, no humans. There's just water, and it's endless. And suddenly, we don't quite know how and why, a little boat appears. And inside the boat sits a figure, and we will call this figure God. So God is in his boat, and he's floating amidst this endless ocean. And one day, he looks into the water and suddenly sees his reflection. And the water becomes kind of foamy, and out of this reflection comes another being, another creature. And this creature jumps into the boat. And this creature introduces itself, and he says, "I am the devil." So here you have God and devil in a boat. And they're floating. They're probably having an interesting conversation. And one day, God decides to create land. For some reason, he knows that deep below this watery abyss, at the very bottom, there is sand, there is soil. But because he belongs to the upper world, he cannot pick it up himself. So he has to ask the creature that comes from this watery realm, he has to ask the devil for help. So he says, "Devil, I need your help. I need you to bring this handful of soil to the surface. But remember, in doing so, you have to say, 'I take this soil in God's name.'" So the devil agrees, of course, and he just dives into the water and goes all the way down, picks this handful of sand. And as he emerges, he says, "I take this soil in my own name." He opens his hand and he finds nothing, of course. So he has to do it one more time. So he dives and he picks up this handful of soil. Then he comes to the surface and he says, "I take this soil in my own name." And again, he finds nothing. So he has to do it the third time. And then he picks it up, goes up, and he says, "I take this soil in God's name and my own." And then he opens his hand and he finds this little grain. He jumps into the boat, gives it to God, and then God picks up this little grain and casts it onto the surface of the ocean. And what happens is this little grain begins to grow, and it eventually turns into a little island. When the island is big enough, the two deities, God and devil, they jump out of their boat and they make land. And God is very tired of this act of creation, so he decides to lie down and take a little nap. So he falls asleep, and as he's sleeping, the devil thinks, okay, now I can get rid of him and take full control over this beautiful island. So what the devil does is he tries to push God into the water, and he pushes him to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west. God does not belong to the watery realm, so you cannot drown him. And what actually happens instead is that the island only becomes bigger. It just expands like dough under a rolling pin. It just stretches in all these cardinal directions. And then God finally wakes up. And of course, he's very pissed off. So what he does is he starts striking the devil with lightning, and the devil jumps and hides under a stone, and he hides under a tree. But God is chasing him constantly. Now, there is a possible variant of the story where the gods either take the form of animals, and I think these animals were flying and roaring serpents or dragons, or they create their avatars in the form of snakes or dragons. But essentially, there is this conflict between the two opposing forces of the watery realm and the upper realm, light and dark and fire and water and so on. So they fight. They're engaged in the struggle. And eventually, the devil jumps back into the ocean. And then God says, "Yes, this is your realm, and this is where you will remain, and I shall be the ruler of this island and of this world." So that is the basic story, the basic myth that we have from Slavic folklore. And here you can see this idea of the two serpents fighting the domination of over the world's, the control of the world. And this fight seems to be an idea that is fundamental to our understanding of Slavic belief. So there's a black metal band called Samael, and they have this album called Ceremony of Opposites. And I think this is the ceremony of opposites, you know, fire and water and light and dark. But the conflict has to continue. It's a cyclic conflict for world domination. And neither of the two deities ever wins because, you know, everything works in cycles. You have to have winter, which is symbolized by these devilish powers. And then you have spring, which is symbolized by all these celestial lightning, the first thunder, and so on. So this is a conflict that keeps the world in its existence, that makes the world go round, literally. And you can see here that as I said, that if you break the story down, you have two opposing powers that represent two different domains. Usually in the folklore, you have beings that are labeled God and devil, but we can make an educated guess that in the sort of original variant from the Viking Age, they were, of course, not called God and devil. And most likely the deity of the sky was called Perun, like I mentioned earlier. So the kind of equivalent of Thor or other sky deity. And the other creature, the devil, was most likely called Veles or Triglaf, the three-headed one, the one you can remember from the pillar. So he is the god of the underworld. This is the basic story, the cosmogonic myth, the myth of the world's creation. And for a very long time, we didn't have any archaeology to illustrate the existence of this myth back in the 10th, 11th centuries. I think we actually now have it. So I don't know how much time we've got left, but
we have as much time as you want. I'm loving this.
I can show you what the archaeology is or what the archaeology can be.
I have questions about the myth first.
All right.
I have as much time as you have. I'm not going anywhere. This is so much fun for me. I just love learning about things I just have never heard of. Do you think that it's when the god figure, Perun, looks into the sea and sees his reflection, do you think that's almost like a doppelganger type thing of it's almost an exact copy of him as a devil figure, or it's its own being? Does that make sense?
I think there are different variants of the story. So one is where he looks into the water and sees a reflection. There's another where there's just like, you know, this foaming water, or just something comes out of the water. There are different variants. But I think the idea that it's a reflection and that there is the sense of duality.
Yeah.
That it's kind of the same, but it's not the same. And one cannot exist without the other. I think that's where we are touching the core of essentially Slavic beliefs. Everything in the Slavic world seems to be based on this idea of duality. That's not something that is so clear in the Norse system of belief. Well, you have hints of it. Yeah, you have these different opposing powers. But I think for the Slavs, the idea, the double is very important. It's the fundamental thing here.
Do you think that's down to lack of, like you say, lack of source material and so it's hard to maybe expand beyond this because nobody can really say. So I assume there would be other factors and other gods at play.
I'm sure. Yes, of course. They're you know, it's a 1 or 2 hour podcast, so we cannot cover everything. But that's the reason why I'm picking certain details and certain stories. There's more. There's a little bit more that we can use. But generally, the problem with Slavic mythology is that it's fragmented. It's patchy. It's a sort of a patchwork belief system as it comes down to us today. So we cannot discuss it in so much detail as we can with the Norse beliefs, because simply we don't have as many sources, especially texts. Because the reason why we understand the Norse belief system so well is because we have all these texts. We have the, you know, the poems, we have the poetic Edda, we have the sagas, then we have folklore, and we can, you know, mix and match and verify and cross check these different sources. And they're also written in the vernacular language, more or less. Yeah. And the runic inscriptions and all that.
Oh, isn't it? I just had a thought.
It's a huge advantage.
Yeah, but how fascinating is how you get, obviously, like the Abrahamic faith, you have like the Bible, the Quran, where you have these texts that are pretty much like, this is it. Like, this book here is everything. But then you have, of course,
it's not. And also in the Scandinavian world.
No, but that's what I mean. Then you have the Nordic ones who are then like the next, like, it's almost like the next step down from that, where you have like all these texts, but you can't take them at face value. There is so much complexity to them. They're, most of them, like, say, are written by like Christian sources or Arabic sources. So it's like the next step down. But then you get even further removed from that and go to like the Slavic one, where you have pretty much nothing. It's like this, it's like a very fascinating kind of like pyramid.
Yeah, but that's why it's interesting, especially for me as an archaeologist. It's interesting to try and understand these belief systems in different cultures, because sometimes if you have a sort of profound knowledge of one system of belief from the same time, then you can use some of this knowledge to try and fill certain gaps in another system of belief, because on some fundamental levels, these religions were similar and certain practices were very similar. So you can approach it in a sort of comparativist way. And that helps. For me, it's actually has been my modus operandi, my research procedure, because I've always had an interest in the Slavic world, but my main interest, has been the Scandinavian world. So I began with Scandinavia and Scandinavian sources and Old Norse sources and Viking archaeology. And then I moved on to the Slavic world. So I'm kind of also, like you, kind of approaching the Slavic world as a kind of outsider, but at the same time an insider, because I speak Slavic.
But I guess it gives you a different angle to look at it from that maybe other people I've missed.
I think it has helped me a lot, and has certainly helped me reinterpret certain objects in the archaeology of the Slavic world and view them in a different way than some of my colleagues have been viewing them for a very long time. And that can lead to a lot of groundbreaking results, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You need that sometimes when
you need an outsider perspective sometimes on all kinds of things, and I think that's valuable.
I mean, that's almost like how this podcast started. It's one of the ideas behind it was that, you know, you have we have so many scholars on here, and particularly, and also like with Matthias, you know, I think scholars almost become you exist in your own, I guess, echo chamber of like talking to other scholars and kind of become blinded to seeing things the same way over and over and over. And then when you try, I'm kind of speaking as a broad sense, when it then comes to like talking to maybe lay people like me, you almost overlook the very basics because you assume a level of understanding that maybe is amongst the scholars, but it's overlooked when it comes to kind of just the everyday person.
Exactly.
And this kind of gives the opportunity of somebody like me to be like, I don't understand this. What's this little thing here? Can you tell me what this is?
That's one of the great problems of academia generally, where, you know, professional academics go to these conferences and you have to often pay to attend the conference, and they are not open to the public. And it's a bunch of people sitting in a room talking to themselves without any audience. And then they're publishing whatever they've discussed in super expensive journals and super expensive books that most normal people cannot buy. Mm-hmm. And what is it all for? I sometimes wonder. And I think if there is a future for academia, we have to open up to everybody and be as inclusive as we possibly can, and listen and be open to other people from other cultures, from other backgrounds. And that's the way to push the research forward. Of course, we won't always agree, but mm-hmm. we have to be open to these kinds of conversations. And the worst thing you can do is say, oh, I'm not listening to you because you don't have a PhD. Mm-hmm. So what? It doesn't matter. Someone can just have a great idea, and maybe that idea is worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
That's my take. You know?
Yeah, and I think you've got it's a brilliant perspective to have, because it feels like every other week on my academia.edu, I see your name popping up with a new paper that people can read. But that's...
Yeah, and I wish all my work was open access mm-hmm. and that everyone could read it. But some things I just cannot upload on academia because there's a contract and it forbids yeah. me to share this. Yeah. So it's extremely unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that most of the articles we write for these journals that then appear behind a 30-40 euro or pound paywall, we actually yeah. don't get paid for it as authors.
Okay, yeah.
So how crazy is that?
Yeah, it is very disappointing because, yeah. you know, we get asked all the time, how can people read more? Yeah. And there are people out there who just want to read as much as they can. And maybe, you know, it is frustrating because it's particularly in the Nordic side of things, like the Nordic mythology, you get a certain group of people who just... they're happy just being like the entry level, and they'll just think of whatever they see on the TV shows or read on Wikipedia is true. Mm. And that's that. It's fine. They can exist as they are, but there are so many people who want to do that further reading, and they want to get deeper involved. And for whatever reason, maybe they didn't have the opportunity when they were younger to go to university to study this further, whether it's, you know, for whatever happened in life, or maybe they just didn't get interested in this until later in life. And then, you know, you have responsibilities like kids, house, all those things, and you can't then go back to university. So it would be nice for everything just to be as accessible as possible.
Exactly.
People can just dive in and try and learn as much.
Yeah, but that's a bit of an off topic from
it is a little bit, yeah,
our discussions on
I have it all the time because we will move on to the archaeology.
No, but it's, of course, very important what we just said. I think it's we have to try our best to make things as accessible as possible.
It hits me all the time because, like I say, I spend a lot of my weekends just going around different places and trying to look at Viking Age finds, particularly like within Yorkshire. And I keep getting hit with red tape, particularly from like... a lot of these things end up in churches anyway, but it's fascinating how some of them are so open. The church is open all the time. You can go in, you can look, you can take pictures. They're not bothered. They love it. They're really proud that the history is there.
Great.
But then you get some that are just like, okay, we have this little bit of history, but it's ours. And you can't come in and take pictures of it. Yeah. And you can only come and look at it if we say you can come and look at it.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're not even going to give you permission to come and look at it. And that's what I find so frustrating. It's like, you don't really own this. You just happen to be your church. Your church would
be. The idea of being a curator is not the idea of ownership. You're mm-hmm. curating it. You're not owning something. You're there to make sure it's safe. But you should, give people access. Of course, not everyone can access it for various reasons. Yeah, there are certain objects that are fragile that require certain conditions to for them to survive the next couple of hundred years. But knowledge should be accessible.
It should be. I, in particular, the one I'm referring to, and I'll name it on here. I don't care. There's a Sigurd cross fragment that exists in the Ripon Cathedral, and this fragment of a cross is just sat in a back room. Uh-huh. It's not. They know it's of some importance. It's one of four Sigurd cross pieces in the UK. And it's just in a back room, sat there. It's not on display. And it's so frustrating because, you know, I wrote to them and said, can I come and see it? I'd love to make a video about it. It's really cool. And it's like, no, we plan on doing something with it. We understand its importance. We will do something with it at some point. It's just like...
in 20 years.
Yeah, so it doesn't take much for you just to put it out and put a little plaque with it or something.
Yeah.
I find things like that very frustrating.
Yeah, that happens.
But anyway... Back to the archaeological.
There's one other thing I want to show you, and I think that is an extension to what we've been talking about, and with very interesting implications for the wider Viking themed research. So it requires a little bit of an introduction into Slavic or West Slavic archaeology. But if we have time, we can quickly run through a couple of slides. So in the next couple of minutes, I'll take you on a journey to Poland, and you can see the map of the country as it appears today, with some of the major cemeteries from the Viking Age marked and underlined, and I will show you some of the finds from two sites. One of them is called Lutomirsk, and you can see it in the middle of the picture, right in the very, almost in the very center of the country. And the other site is called Ciepłe. It's in the north of Poland, not far away from Gdańsk or Danzig. If you know Gdańsk, it's quite a famous historical city, a very popular, especially among Scandinavian tourists. That's not far away from Gdańsk. So our story begins in this place called Lutomirsk in central Poland. And it begins in the 1940s. And that was a very dark time in history and European history, especially in Polish history, the time of the Second World War and of the Nazi occupation. Mm-hmm. And in 1940, the Nazis, who already got a very strong foothold in Poland, gathered Jews from the ghetto in Łódź, a big city in central Poland, and took them to this little village of Lutomirsk to force them to destroy an existing Jewish cemetery. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to use stone slabs from the cemetery, gravestones, essentially, for the construction of a road. That was a common thing that the Nazis did, destroying religious heritage of other cultures and just, you know, using it as building material. This is the dark kind of story behind what is about to happen behind an excavation. So what happens in 1940 is one of the workers, upon destroying this cemetery, comes across a Viking Age sword unexpectedly. So it appears that underneath this Jewish cemetery was an earlier cemetery from the Viking Age. And of course, picks up the sword. The Nazis are thrilled because it looks like a very old thing. It looks kind of Viking. Mm-hmm. So for them, from an ideological point of view, well, this is something really important, because based on that find, they can then build an argument saying, oh, there were Vikings in the very heart of Poland from Scandinavia. So the mm-hmm. Germanic world was here. And that is great from their perspective. So what they did is they almost immediately launched an excavation campaign, hoping to find more Viking traces in Lutomirsk. And they excavated about 15 graves, but they found nothing in those early medieval Viking Age graves. They found nothing of Scandinavian origin or diagnostically in Scandinavian style. So they abandoned the dig. They sent the finds to Poznań, where I'm based right now, actually, to a museum in Poznań. And only after the war, Polish archaeologists in 1949 decided to return to the site and excavate it yet again to its full extent. And the idea behind this Polish excavation was to verify if the Nazis were right or wrong about the alleged Viking-ness of the cemetery and of the people buried there. And what is really interesting is that the professor who was running this excavation, the Polish Polish scholar, Konrad Jaszczewski, arranged the start of this excavation so that it would coincide with the visit of a very prominent Swedish archaeologist called Holger Arbman. Now, for those of you who know Scandinavian archaeology, this name Arbman rings a bell. This is the guy who published some of the grave finds from Birka in Sweden, the famous cemetery. Arbman was the guy who published the finds, the graves, the plans, the objects, and so on. He was an expert in Scandinavian archaeology, so for the Polish archaeologist Konrad Jaszczewski, this visit was very important because he wanted Arbman to verify if there are any Vikings in Lutomirsk or not. Mm. So Arbman came, he looked at the finds, and he said, no, there's nothing Scandinavian here, there's nothing diagnostically Nordic here, but maybe you have something Eastern European, maybe you have something that points to the Rus direction. He wasn't quite sure. Now, unfortunately, we don't know exactly what he saw and what finds he was talking about, but we can speculate. And it's possible that he had the opportunity to see two of the graves from the cemetery. And here you can see the plan of the site. And these two graves are labeled graves 5 and 10. And these graves are in the middle part of the site. They're marked with these red circles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can see that the middle part of the cemetery, all these squares are graves, and they form a row. It's almost like they're arranged along a road, perhaps a processional road, where people would have, you know, conducted all kinds of funerary rituals and processions and so on. And the graves are interesting. They have roughly the same contents, but they represent two different traditions. So one is a cremation, so the body was burnt, and the other is an inhumation, so the whole body was buried in the grave.
Okay.
And you can see some of the stuff that was in there. You can see these round things, and these are parts of a bridle, distributors for a bridle. And I actually have a replica here, so I'm not going to put it on because it's for a horse, but you can see these little animal heads.
Yes.
So there were four altogether, and you'd put it on the horse's head, and it would have looked really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the same grave also had a very strange copper alloy object with little animal figures attached to it.
Just before you go on to that little round thing with the animal heads, I don't, obviously it's the first time I've seen it, but I recognize those little heads, and I don't know where from or what, but they look kind of like, I imagine it's something that Luciano Pizzoli, who does the Children of Ash, has shown me.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something in them that just strikes me as something he's shown us on this podcast before. Like there's just the shape of them with the little ears. They just stood out to me straight away. I was like, oh, I've seen those before, or something very similar to that.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. But I think what's important now to remember is that there are three.
Okay.
Three heads. And you already know something about three heads from
earlier.
In the talk. So that was in this grave, as well as this very strange kind of U-shaped object with animal figures. And the same kind of object with three animals is something that was found in grave 10, this inhumation grave. And you can see it on the sort of in the center of the image to the right, on the left hand side, more or less. So you will see a larger photo in a second. here you go. This is the grave number 10, reconstruction showing how it may have appeared at the time of burial. And you can see the rest of the gear that was buried with this person. So again, you have elements of writing equipment, and these two things in the upper left corner. These are so-called cheek pieces. So that's something that you attach to the horse bit to make it hold better in the horse's mouth to stabilize the bit. Mm-hmm. But it also has a decorative aspect, of course, and these here are very decorative. And what you can notice on in the decor is that at first glance it looks kind of floral, but what it actually represents, and it's not immediately clear now, but you will see why I think it represents what it represents, is that you actually have two flying snakes or two flying serpents.
Okay.
That are flanking something that looks like a tree.
Yeah.
Now, I also have a replica because I like to commission replicas. So that's the replica of the bit.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's the thing that goes into the mouth of the animal.
Yeah.
And that is the cheek piece. So you can
see it
shining like gold. It was made of copper alloy, and you can see the beasts here flanking a central tree. Motif. And then finally, you can see the strange U-shaped object. And when they found it, they weren't quite sure what it was. So the original interpretation was that it was a part of a saddle, a kind of a saddle bow fitting or something. But what it actually is, as you can see and you can read from the slide, is actually part of a spur, and quite an elaborate one. Mm-hmm. The problem for these original excavators was that they couldn't quite immediately recognize it as a spur, because for the spur to work, you need a goad. That's the thing that goads the animal. So you need this long kind of prick-like thingy at the end. And it was missing for some strange reason. So they couldn't quite figure it out. And all these things, as wonderful as they are, in the 1940s seemed very exotic to the excavators, and probably to Arbman as well. That's why I presume that this is what he saw, and he thought, this cannot be Slavic or West Slavic. This is definitely not Scandinavian. Maybe it's somewhere from the East,
somewhere else.
Somewhere in Asia. These are probably some nomads. We don't know. And this interpretation of all this gear, and you can here see the reconstructed bridles and on horse heads, all these interpretations they kind of prevailed for decades on, and only until the last couple of years we have actually begun to understand what these objects are and what they communicate and how important they are also for Slavic mythology and our understanding of Slavic mythology. And the real game changer is what I'm going to show you now came when Zdzisława Ratajczyk, who was an archaeologist in the archaeological museum in Gdańsk, excavated a cemetery in Ciepłe. That's the site close to Gdańsk in the early 2000s. And she unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but her excavation skills and documentation skills were excellent. So the site was excavated to a very, very high standard. And we can now do a lot of fantastic analysis of this material. Together with another colleague, Kamil Kajkowski, I had the privilege to work with Zdzisława on some of this material. And it was a fascinating adventure. So what did she find? Well, she found a cemetery in many ways similar to Lutomiersk, but also very rich, or even richer than Lutomiersk, with a number of chamber graves, including weapons and riding gear. But one of the graves had the exact same spur.
And it looks so similar.
It's exactly the same in terms of its design, at least. And it's complete. It has the missing goad. And it also has other parts that made it possible to attach it to a shoe.
Wow.
So here you can see another image actually from the excavation showing where the spurs were placed in the grave. And you can see that the presumed rider had the spurs on his feet. So wow. it was a person sort of fitted for an otherworldly journey, presumably on a horseback. The problem is that the horse was not in the grave. The horse was missing. There are actually no horse remains or large horse remains from the site. We don't know where the horses are, but he's ready for a ride, for an otherworldly journey to the afterlife. Here again, you can see a reconstruction of the grave by my colleague Mirosław Kuzma. We've been collaborating on these different reconstructions for many years. So that brings the image of the grave in its presumed form.
Yeah.
Now, this is again the spur. You can see it enlarged, and you can see some of the details. So on the goad, you can see an animal with its head turned to the back, presumably a horse. Maybe that's the missing horse from the grave. Then you can see these three animals on the arms of the spur that have these presumably horns on their heads.
Yes.
You can also see these little bells attached to the arms of the spur. And at the terminals, you can see the head of another animal, presumably a snake. There were also other elements of the spur, which included parts of a buckle and a fastening mechanism. And the object was so interesting that we have, together with my colleagues, actually tried to reconstruct it in order to restore its original appearance, making a replica. And one of my colleagues, who is a very experienced rider, has also used it in action.
Oh, wow.
So what you can see here is the replica. And I also have it.
Have it. Oh, nice.
So this restores the object to its original appearance, to its original beauty. And you can hear that it actually has its own voice and it makes its own sound. If you can hear it. These are the bells rattling. Uh-huh. But when the rider was wearing this, people could hear him approaching. And they were probably shitting their pants.
Yeah.
When someone like that was coming close,
but you better listen.
The reconstruction, the replica was made by a very talented jeweler called Tomasz Czyszczoń, and Kornelia Ryłko, his wife. They are working together. They have a very they're very skilled, and they have this wonderful workshop. And this is the best replica of these spurs that has ever been made. And it's largely thanks to them that we can understand the fastening mechanism, which is quite unusual. But of course, all this detail implies that, well, it was there for a reason, that there is some kind of meaning behind it.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Together with Kamil Kajkowski, an archaeologist from Bytów in Poland, and with Zdzisława Ratajczyk from the Archaeological Museum in Gdańsk, as well as with the writer Bartek Ligocki and Tomasz, the photographers, we have speculated and kind of tried to unravel the meanings of this strange object. And we think that it has something to do with Slavic mythology, and that it's in one way or another linked to that cosmogonic myth that I told you earlier. So we think that the way to understand this object is to read it along two different axes, so to say. So you have the horizontal axis and you have the vertical axis. That's how you read the comic book from the Slavic world. So what you can see on the strap is the upper world. It's basically the horizon. And there's also a disc on the strap that slides and holds the strap in place.
Okay, yeah.
And the disc has a swastika motif.
Mm-hmm.
It's most likely the representation of the sun that travels on the horizon and rises and falls and rises and falls on this, in the cycle of life, so to say.
Yeah.
Then you have the buckle and the fittings. And if you look closely, you will see in the lower left corner that at first glance, this just looks like a decorated buckle. But if you look closely, and if, even if you turn your head 90 degrees, you'll notice that there are actually two snakes on either side. They're touching with their mouths. You see that? They're
Yeah.
And then you have these guys here, these kind of bird-shaped fittings. Now, what happens here is that for the strap to work, to close it, these flying snakes and these crawling snakes on the buckle, they have to interlock. They have to clash, so to say. And if you remember what I told you about, you know, the Slavic cosmogonic myth and these snakes fighting in the sky, well, this is exactly what's happening here. They are engaged in some kind of cosmic struggle. In the sky. Now, here you can see this horse. And of course, anyone who knows anything about past religions knows that the horse is a creature that can travel between worlds. And I think that this is what is happening here. And you can see that below the horse on this goat, there's no ornament. It's all plain.
Yeah.
There's a little wavy pattern in front of the animal, which implies that this creature is standing somewhere, I think, on a shore, and its head turned backwards seems to suggest that it's capable of traveling into whatever is behind or on the water and to come back. So I think we could make a guess that this is the horse that travels between worlds and presumably transports human souls into the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And this is what we can see on the arms of the spur. So you see these three animals, presumably cattle. That's how we interpret these creatures, on a wavy pattern. So on water or on an island. And there's other stories in the corpus of Slavic folklore suggesting that in the afterlife, human souls took the form of cattle. So this is probably what we are looking at here. This is the representation of the afterlife where human souls turn into cattle. And then finally, you have the bell and this this fitting. And if you close this fitting, it has to go kind of through the slider and down below this wavy pattern. So it's kind of like the way I'd suggest this is the way to read it. It dives underwater. So maybe this is a reference to that holy diver motif where the diver dives down and picks the grain of soil. Mm-hmm. All this may be wrong, of course, but as you can see, there are certain parallels here to the few stories that we have left. There are certain ways to try and decipher it. Go into further detail and deconstruct the symbolism, and this is something that we've done with Kamil Kajkowski and with Zdzisława Ratajczyk in a big article. We wrote a 100-page article where all this is, you know, broken into pieces and interpreted. But on a very basic level, this is how we can try and figure this out.
Mm-hmm. How much does it help having the replica that you've made? Because that must make so much different being able to hold it and manipulate it and look
at
it.
Absolutely. That was one of the reasons for making this replica. We've actually altogether three replicas have been made. There was one that I commissioned back in 2014 from a different artist known as Moimira. She made one replica for me, but at that point I didn't have enough detail. I hadn't seen the original find yet. I only had photographs. I was teaching Slavic warfare in Rzeszów. It's a university in the south of Poland. And so I made it sort of building on my growing fascination with Slavic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Then another colleague of mine, Bartosz Ligocki, he commissioned his replica from Tomasz, but they also didn't have some of the data that I was kind of acquiring at that time. And then finally, I commissioned the final replica, the third replica from Tomasz, which is as exact as it can be, and as authentic as it can be. The interesting thing from a technological point of view is that you can see this goad was not cast together with the rest of the spur's body. It's actually a separate piece. And it's designed in a very particular way because it actually has an iron core.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cast over an iron rod and then riveted to the arms of the spur.
Yeah.
And that's also really interesting because it seems that these things were not totally stable or permanently fixed, and they would sometimes fall off. And we find those spurs across the Viking world, which is great for it was probably a tragedy for the rider to lose something like this, but it's great for us as archaeologists because based on these variously distributed spur goads, we can actually trace the trajectories, the mobility of these riders. Mm-hmm. And we can see how far their contacts extended and where they went, and then speculate on what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a couple of spur goads like this from Poland, but we also have some in Scandinavia,
mm-hmm.
including Denmark and Sweden. So that shows again some very close intercultural contacts here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're going to have to come back and talk more about this. We're going to have to, because we're coming up close on like 2 hours, so we're going to have to. You're going to have to come back and talk.
Yeah,
to me
that's.
Again.
I think that's a good place to stop. And
yeah. I think the last thing I wanted to ask is, unless I'm remembering this incorrectly, when we last spoke, we spoke about female warriors. Am I wrong in thinking that there was a spur in a female warrior grave that you speculated might have been from the Slavic region? I've not made that up, right? Was there something like that?
Kind of, if I remember correctly. Actually, I believe I said that there were actually no spurs.
Okay, maybe that was
if
it.
If we're talking about the Birka grave,
maybe that was
Birka
it. Maybe
warrior woman's grave. That one didn't have spurs, but it had stirrups. And I said,
okay,
spurs, but with stirrups is something Eastern like.
Okay, yeah.
It represents the kind of Eastern way of mounted warfare, riding, and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I just remembered
so
there
that's
was
probably,
something
that's
there.
Been,
that was it, yeah. I remember there was something, but I couldn't quite remember exactly what it was. Let's wrap this up because we are going to do a little Q&A with the patrons. I'm not going
to
keep
that's
you
a good,
too
that's
long.
A good point to stop. And
But I love these episodes where, like I say, I'm learning something new. The chat is silent, so that means everybody's sat actually listening and not talking amongst themselves. And, you know, my favorite episodes are where I forget that I'm recording a podcast, where I just feel like I'm sat here just having a conversation with somebody. I forget that there's people listening or that there are going to be people listening. I forget about the chat. It's just I'm locked in and kind of just obsessed with whatever you're saying. So I really appreciate this. Has been a lot of fun, and you do have to come back. You're always one of my favorite guests. That's why I pester you so much.
It'll be my pleasure.
So I'm pestering you all the time to be like, Lish, when you can come back and talk to me again. Okay, is there anything you want to plug, shout out, where people can find your work, anything you want them to buy? Everybody go support Lishik.
Yeah, you can find my work on academia.edu, and if there's something you cannot find, then you can always contact me via email or through Facebook. And I will just, when it comes to the Slavic stuff, I will just leave it here for today. But I can kind of silently announce that there is a new project coming up soon.
Good.
Concerning some of this material, but also its connection with the Scandinavian world.
Wonderful.
And I cannot say anything else right now, but it's coming.
Well, hopefully, then next time, hopefully when you come back, there'll be something more concrete you can say, and we can make people give you some money somehow.
That's always nice.
It is always nice because that book collection needs to get bigger.
Exactly.
Okay, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating, a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can, go check out Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. You get the story time episodes, you get the Q&As with the guests. You can ask the guests your questions as well beforehand or during the live show. And there's a bunch of material on there you can go and check out. But yeah, Leszek, thank you very much. Let's have a couple of minutes break. I'm just going to run to the bathroom and then we will jump in and do the Q&A.
Great. Sounds great.